rolling.
Hey, what's this shit?
Prepare for a gopher football knowledge bomb. This is the FBT podcast with hosts MV.
We are, folks. You starting to believe now? We're 3-0. Feels good, man. This is my radio smooth talk voice. Hello, everybody. This is the FBT podcast. I'm your host, MV. I'm here once again with the rest of the FBT Brain Trust, Frothy Gopher.
What up?
And Sir Elliot Man.
What's going on, guys?
So, as we sit here, 3-0 for the first time since 2008. We are about to play the most important game of the Jerry Kill era and probably the most important game played at TCF Bank Stadium since it opened in 2009, other than perhaps the Air Force or Wisconsin game that year. And what do we have on our hands but QB Gaze 2002?
Yeah, I don't know why we'd want to talk about going 4-0, you know, for the first time in a long time. And I don't know why we'd want to talk about Syracuse coming in. Another good team, give USC everything they could handle, had some troubles with Stony Brook last week. You know, here we are 3-0. There may be a good narrative there, but why talk about that when you can talk about, oh, I don't know, a backup quarterback comes in, saves the day for us. Is he going to be the starter? Is he not going to be the starter? Does it make any difference since Gray is going to be out for at least the next 2 or 3 weeks? No, let's talk about that instead.
Exactly. Well, especially, it's always important to remember Max Shortell has red hair. And so it's a ginger nation, basically. You have the East Coast bias, you have the red hair bias. You can't hide from it.
All right. Yeah, he is a daywalker, and he did steal the souls of the Western Michigan Bronco defense, especially on that really nice, you know, 53-yard bomb to AJ. Not really a bomb, but it was a nice pattern to AJ Barker over a safety and a linebacker, just fantastically placed. So I'm going to get right into it here. QB Gaze 2012 doesn't exist, and the reason why it doesn't exist is because there's no debate right now. We do not have two quarterbacks available to this team. We only have one healthy quarterback, and that is Max Shortell. Marquise Gray is not going to play next week against Syracuse. In all likelihood, won't play against Iowa, because high ankle sprains generally have about a 2 to 4 week recovery rate. So we're looking more along the lines of that Gray will heal through the bye week and then perhaps come back against Northwestern or maybe even Wisconsin, depending upon how he's healing. But yes, Max Shortell did the job. It looked great in relief, especially in those first two series where he came right in, was rifling passes, caught Western Michigan off guard. And one of the things that was mentioned at the press conference after the game from Shortell was that the offense really felt like they needed a spark and they were going to open up the passing game anyway, but it just so happened that it happened with Shortell versus with Gray. So, I mean, of course, there's going to be some healthy amount of debate about that. But I'm interested to hear your guys' thoughts about this whole this whole debate that everybody, you know, it was sort of like a it's not really a groundswell, but it was like there was a very slow rumblings in the back of everyone's head. And I think very certain specific beat writers and portions of the Gopher fan base were sort of waiting for this to happen as like the confirmation bias that yes, Shortell needs to be the starter. He's the guy that's going to make this offense go and make us that much more lethal. But you know, why don't the coaches play him? Gray can't be a quarterback. Let's move him back to wide receiver type Gaze.
Well, I guess this is the way that I look at it. Something absolutely changed during that game yesterday when Shortell came in. Now, to your comments after the press conference, they were going to open up the offense more, etc. But there was palpable excitement in the stadium once we started throwing the ball around. The question that I have is, why weren't we throwing the ball around more before that? We really haven't seen the Gray get to throw the ball around like that, with the exception of, you know, the UNLV game where there were several overthrown balls. Didn't get a chance to do that against UNA, against New Hampshire, because we really didn't need to. And then it seemed like we needed to open things up. We certainly needed to open things up against Western Michigan yesterday. But we only did it once Shortell came in. Now, yeah, it's absolutely possible, probable even, that that was going to happen regardless of whether Shortell or Gray was in the game. But it wasn't until Shortell came in the game that the passes start getting zipped around, opened things up a little bit, paid dividends in the running game later on. So, again, that part of that maybe just be confirmation bias. Well, we know that Shortell is a pass quarterback first. Gray is probably more of a run quarterback first. But at the end of the day, something changed with that offense, and it was a completely different offense than we watched for about the first 20 minutes of the game. Now, people are going to take that, and there is a narrative there. There's a story that Shortell comes in, more dynamic offense. You know, this is what we'd like to be. This is what we'd like to see. Now, his second half performance wasn't nearly as good as his first half performance, but we went to a very run-heavy set after that to try and work the clock down. But the story coming out of the game, for those who may not be as into Gopher football as we are, is Shortell came in, more dynamic offense, win the game, etc. You can't not look at that and say that there's a good, strong narrative there. The question is what does that mean when Gray gets healthy? If we perform well for the next several weeks, if we, you know, beat Syracuse, if we give Iowa a game, maybe beat them, going into the bye week as Gray gets better, as Gray recovers from his high ankle sprain, who's going to be starting that game for Northwestern? That's the narrative that the beat writers are going to want to go with. I wonder what your guys' reaction is to that.
Well, I'm interested to see how severe the high ankle sprain is. If it's a severe injury, I think Marquise Gray will be out for several weeks. And now, granted, I'm not a orthopedic surgeon or really very intelligent, even though we were part of the alleged brain trust earlier. I think if Gray can't run at all, you have to sit him, just because I feel still like this team goes as he goes. Even though when Shortell came in, like you said, the game really had changed. It seemed like the play calling changed. The offense really opened up. And all of a sudden they were putting points on the board. I would think that if you have success with Shortell for a couple weeks, I wouldn't rush Gray back against Northwestern. Personally, I would like to see him healthy for Wisconsin, really. Maybe Northwestern is a bigger game because that's, you know, more possibly of a winnable game, I guess. At this point, though, so many people were calling for Shortell and, you know, saying it's kind of a confirmation, you know, really kind of confirmed your bias or people's bias that Shortell was the better quarterback. It's going to be interesting now to see how he really handles when defenses are preparing for him and they prepare the game plan for him. Because it's a lot different when the defense is stacking the box 8-9 against Gray, and then you bring in Shortell and those passing lanes are open. As we saw in the second half, granted, they weren't throwing the ball as much, but he didn't have quite as much success. So I'm interested to see Syracuse and Iowa, especially, to see how Shortell handles that. Granted, he didn't play well last year in a little bit in Purdue and then in Michigan, but it's really unfair to hang all of that on him. Really moving ahead, if Shortell can play reasonably well for the next couple weeks, I think that'd be good to maybe hold Gray until Wisconsin. But at the same point, I think it's still Gray's job to lose, and it shouldn't even be a discussion.
Yeah, so I'm glad you brought up the whole point about the preparation versus coming in relief and then kind of taking a team by surprise. It does become a completely different animal when Syracuse now has seen you on film, not only from the from this particular game that we just played and won, but also against New Hampshire and seeing what his capabilities are, that they're going to start doing things a little bit different. Maybe they don't put as many 8- and 9-man fronts, and then they start dropping more into coverage and force Shortell to make better reads and get things into tighter windows. Now, the question I have, so people have this sort of idea. So it's a conflicting philosophy on offense. Are you more likely to have success in the running game if you have a quarterback that can really pass the ball and then can hit receivers? By the way, I have to interject that our receivers are so much better than they were at the same point last year. I mean, the fact that we have guys like Barker and Frickty and Derek Ingle who can consistently get open, run great routes, and they're just running free all over the place. I mean,
white speed receiver you.
We are white speed receiver you. So the fact that we have receivers now that can get open and get behind coverages for Chartel to hit, is that going to be enough to sort of pull those safeties and corners from the boundary out of the box and free up the offensive line to really block well for Donnell Kirkwood and James Gillum, versus the conflicting philosophy, or not conflicting, but converse philosophy is you have a running quarterback, you are pound, pound, pound through the tackles with your running quarterback and your running back run game. And then because you're facing these sort of stacked fronts, then you have the capability of hitting play action over the top. Now, like to Frothy's point, we saw more of that in the UNLV game, where Gray absolutely had made passes that he needed to in the fourth quarter, but struggled to hit receivers throughout the game, and he missed some wide open targets that I think is the ideal for this offense. Didn't do anything against New Hampshire, and then for the first 20 minutes of this particular game, really wasn't asked to do anything on first down. Like, I saw one particular stat that I find just absolutely stunning is Lime Grover let Gray throw the ball 7 times on first down against UNLV. He let him throw 4 out of his 8 passes against New Hampshire were on first down, play action, first down, quick strike type of things. Against Western Michigan, 0 of his passes came on first down. He passed only when he had to in passing situations. Now, I know that they probably maybe borrowed the game plan from New Hampshire, which was to keep the New Hampshire offense off the field because they're a quick strike, no huddle, we don't want to wear our defense down type philosophy. But at the same time, Western Michigan didn't do a whole hell of a lot of that. I mean, they did some of it, but they were really trying to pound the ball with their, you know, 2 tight end single back sets. So I almost think that the way in which we set them up at the early part of the game kept them in the game longer than they should have been. And it really was only that spark that just coincidentally, we can say that it happened when Chartel came in the game to rattle off those two quick touchdowns. But anyway, so it's like that's the philosophy there. I mean, you have to be able to trust your quarterback throwing the ball. Now, I feel like Lime Grover implicitly trusts Chartel more to throw the ball simply because he is a pure passer and he can do a little bit of running on the sneaky zone read a little bit. But I'm interested to hear what you guys think about that particular issue. That is it just because Lime Grover trusts Chartel to do that portion of the offense, or that fits his strength? And then how much of an impact do you think changing the offense fairly dramatically to suit Chartel's needs versus Gray's is going to have in the next coming weeks?
Well, if I can just jump in real quick and then I'll get out of the way, but just to your point of Lime Grover almost trusting Chartel throwing the ball more in, you know, against New Hampshire when he came in garbage time, seemingly, he attempted 6 passes, and up until that point, Gray had only attempted 8. And then as soon as, you know, like we said, against Western Michigan, he came in and he was throwing all over the place. So it would seem as though, for whatever reason, maybe that it was just the UNLV game frustrated the coaching staff that much, or I don't know. But it would seem as though they have more confidence throwing the ball through Chartel. And maybe they just – he's obviously not the running threat that Marquise Gray is, and maybe they feel like Kirkwood won't get the same lanes, or they can stack the box then, I guess, if they try to run with Chartel back there.
Yeah, it's a tough question. My gut tells me that, yes, absolutely, Lime Grover trusts Chartel to throw the ball more, and so we're going to see a more pass-oriented offense. But that doesn't – I don't see a radical shift in our offensive philosophy. I think we're going to continue to do the same things, but I think we'll be passing more. Now, I have attended all three of the games, you know, good for me, in person, and I haven't had a chance to sit down and watch any of the games on TV in a replay. So my view may be different just because I haven't had as much of an opportunity to watch the film. But what I will say, at least in the replays that I've seen from some of the New Hampshire highlights, you know, Gray only attempted 8 passes, but there were more plays where it may have been drawn up as a pass play. He didn't see anything right away and checked it down and ran. I don't know how many of those there were, so it's possible that, you know, this is pure conjecture on my part. It's possible that they have been calling more passing plays, but Gray has chosen not to pass and takes his run option because he's just more comfortable with that aspect of it. If that's the case, again, Shortell will probably take advantage of those opportunities to pass rather than pull it down and run just based on the type of athlete that he is. But I think we're still going to continue to do some read option. We may do less of it, just given the fact that that's really Gray's strength, whereas it really isn't Shortell's strength, though I certainly think he's capable of doing it. I think we're going to continue to run the ball up the middle, RUTM. It's well noted for failure, though it did serve us pretty well in the fourth quarter, or much of the fourth quarter yesterday until that 4th-and-1. And I think we're going to look for play-action passes. Now, the defensive arrangement, I think, is going to shift pretty radically to your point, MV, where they're going to stop putting 8 or 9 men in the box. They may go, you know, just a standard 7-man front. But that should open up the running game for us. That should make the zone read more effective. And where Shortell isn't going to be as dynamic on the zone read, against a 7-man front, I'd say he's probably going to be close to as effective as Gray would be against a 9-man front. So it opens things up, and if we're able to run the ball, that still leaves the play-action pass for us over the top as teams counter the run up the middle or the zone read. So I think we're going to continue to do the same things. It may not be as dynamic in some ways, but it will be more dynamic in other ways. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. I'm in some ways, I'm kind of glad that you know, Shortell played as well as he did yesterday. Gray may have an opportunity to take a little bit longer to get back, but I'm interested to see if there's a radical shift in offensive philosophy, and I don't believe that there will be, but it'll be interesting to see how defenses respond, whether we see more 7-man fronts rather than 9-man fronts, and whether that opens things up for our offensive line, who quite frankly have struggled to get any push over the first 3 games.
You know, one of the things that I think that we're going to see a lot more of too is that people are going to blitz a hell of a lot more than they probably would before. The Gopher offensive line to this point has been fairly decent in pass protection, notably from, you know, backs like Donnell Kirkwood and James Gillen being pretty good at picking up the blitz and blocking for Gray. But I think that things are going to get a little bit hairier here. I think Shortell is going to face some different looks from defenses than he probably hasn't seen before. I mean, he's probably seen some fire zone going against this defense, but I think they're going to blitz a lot. They're going to try and rattle him. They're going to disrupt his timing with his receivers and confuse him with a lot of different looks as much as possible, because that's the way that you really beat a quote-unquote inexperienced quarterback. Now, Shortell really isn't that inexperienced. I mean, he's still a young quarterback who is going to now be making his third start in his career, but given the fact that has significant amounts of playing time throughout his first 15 games at the U, it'll be an interesting test. I mean, I'm curious to see what the kid's makeup is. This situation is a lot different than it was last year when Shortell was called in. Last year, Gray got hurt. You know, the team was demoralized from the North Dakota State loss. Then they had to go on the road to the Big House. I mean, making your first collegiate start against 110,000 people against what was, you know, a pretty resurgent Greg Madison coach defense was not really the ideal scenario. And then they followed up with a road trip to Purdue, which ended up being equally as big of a disaster there. This time is different because Shortell gets the benefit of knowing that he's going into the game, but that he's also going to be at home against a more manageable opponent that they're going to have film on. He's going to have home crowd support, and it's going to be a big game. I mean, everything has literally been crescendoing throughout the season, and I think it's worked out really well for the Gophers that they started off with a really weak opponent, UNLV, on the road and managed to steal that game in triple overtime. Then they come back and play a FCS opponent who may or may not be as good as UNLV, but certainly all the chips are in our favor with that. Then we gradually ramp it up to a Western Michigan team that's a little bit, that's definitely better than both UNLV and New Hampshire. Now we're playing a Syracuse team that's got the best offense we've faced to date and probably has the best defense that we've faced to date. And they played some teams like Northwestern and USC really tough, but granted, those games were not true road games. So Shortell is going to have his moment here. It's going to be up to him to see what, and whether or not he can handle it is going to be a big question. He doesn't have the benefit of being able to just come in and spring in and surprise defenses by coming in relief. I mean, they are going to key him now. He's the guy. Is he going to be able to handle it? We'll just see.
I'm really interested to see, you kind of touched on it, to see how our offensive line responds. As far as the offensive line was a large concern coming into this year, and then if defenses are going to bring more pressure, bring different looks, to see how they can handle it, especially with the turnover they've already had this year with linemen going out. So I think that'll be definitely something to watch against Syracuse to see, okay, what do we really have with this offensive line? Because Gray's running ability can kind of hide that some, because he, you know, sometimes you're moving the pocket, he's scrambling, he's running. Where Shortell kind of has this sort of, we were watching the game, my wife said he has just kind of this, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, oh shit, you know, look on his face when he's running from pressure. And I like Shortell, but I think that's going to be really telling to see if the offensive line can really form a pocket and let him throw and give him time, especially against Syracuse and then moving into the conference season.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see, and I agree with your assessment, MV, of how the season has gone thus far. I still think, though, that two years ago, we lose the UNLV game. We lose that game yesterday, and I'm unsure about what happens with the New Hampshire game. But I kind of like this because, you know, I had a chance to take a look at some of the message boards this morning, and you know, even some of the tenor of this podcast, right? We're a little cranky, right? The ink-stained wretches are coming up with all these storylines that us hardcore fans may or may not agree with, and I have a viewpoint that may be different from your viewpoint, and we're really kind of treating this a little bit cantankerously. But it's a hell of a lot more fun to be cantankerous with each other when we're 3-0, as opposed to 0-3 or 1-2. So I'm happy that we're having this discussion right now, while we're still undefeated. And I'm happy that Shortell had an opportunity to come in yesterday and prove himself. Whether he's able to carry that over into the Syracuse game and beyond, I'm unsure. But let's have fun with conjecture for a moment here. Let's say we win the Syracuse game, we go down to Iowa, and we beat Iowa, and then go into the bye week. And coming out of the bye week, it looks like Gray is going to be healthy, is going to be able to come back. Do you put him back in the lineup at QB? Let's go Marcus Fuller here. Or do you pull him out, push him out to wide receiver and let Shortell, let Gingerball stay in at quarterback?
My thought process is, though, we'll have to handle that as it comes. But let's be clear about something that Kill has rotated quarterbacks in before and hasn't really been shy about doing it. I mean, in fact, at the beginning of the 2010 season at Northern Illinois, he actually started with DeMarcus Grady. They actually benched Chandler Harnish. Now, Chandler Harnish was also a little bit banged up from fall camp and over the summer, but Harnish wasn't the starter against Illinois or Iowa State, I believe, and he actually came in and started in week 3, and then things just sort of steamrolled from there. So it's not as if Kill hasn't done this in the past and is uncomfortable with playing multiple quarterbacks in the same game. In fact, to your scenario there, Frothy, the team that we would be playing that week has more than adopted a multiple quarterback offense, and they seem to be having success with it. You know, King Coulter is basically our version of Marquise Gray, like, you know, a sort of poor man's Mark Wiesen, that he's the run first, isn't really isn't that great of a passer. And then they have that, I think was his name, Trevor Siemens, I believe his name is. He's supposedly the, you know, more pure passer out of the group, and they actually both get about 20 passing attempts per game, and just like us, Northwestern is 3-0. So it's, I think moving forward, they're going to figure out a way if Gray is not healthy enough to be able to be the Gray that they needed him to be at the beginning of the season. So they will, I think, start folding in Shortell in a little bit more. And if for no other reason, then this team needs to get to a bowl. This team needs to win, because six wins is the watermark. They need to reach it. It would be so important for the future of the, and the direction of this program to get to that six-win mark that they need to do whatever it takes. If they feel like playing Shortell over Gray is going to give them the best chance of win, then they need to do it. If they feel like playing Gray over Shortell is the bit gives them the best chance to win, they need to do that. If they feel like a mixture, whatever ratio of snaps for each is going to get them to win games, that's what they need to do. And I think that's ultimately what it comes down to. Last year, I was squarely on the shoulder. I was squarely on the side of, no, Marquise is your guy. You play him when he's healthy. Don't bring in Shortell. He's a true freshman. You know, he's just, he's, you never want to start a true freshman quarterback, and you don't want to just wait. You don't want to send the wrong message that a guy like Marquise, who had spent the entire offseason, you know, making the transition from wide receiver, put in so much work in order to just, you know, cram in the playbook and the fundamentals of quarterback play, that you don't want to send the message in week two that, okay, nope, we're not going to do it. You're no longer the leader of this team. Go back to playing receiver, and then you can earn NFL paychecks that way. So I was very much anti-QB Gaze 2011. QB Gaze 2012, which doesn't fundamentally exist, I'm neutral on this because, it doesn't exist. Gray isn't healthy. But when Gray does come back to full health, I want to do whatever is going to win six football games for this team.
I feel like it always comes down to what's the best for this team to win. Just like last year, I felt like Gray, with having such a young offensive line, I felt like he could give you a little bit more options with his feet. Like you said, it wasn't really even a choice. But this year, if you can bring in Shortell in certain times, in certain packages, certain quarters, whatever you want to do, and he's giving you a better element throwing the ball, and I guess I don't have a problem with that. The only thing that I think is weird, or not weird, but thing I keep kind of thinking back to, at UNLV, Gray played about as bad as he could without having like a 5-interception game or a 4-interception game. I mean, he missed receivers, but he necessarily wasn't turning the ball over. He just wasn't finishing drives, right? So if they didn't take him out then, when would they take him out? If he's turning the ball over, if he's fumbling, if he can't run, whatever. So I feel like it would have to be just such a dumpster fire for them to bring him in if he wasn't hurt. But like you said, with Gray hurt, if he can't run, then you definitely can't throw him out there. This year, if they have to bring people out, because these are games that they can win right now. I mean, essentially you got your four non-conference games. You want to win all those. Syracuse is a definite winnable game. I didn't look at the early line yet, but it's got to be within 3, I would guess. What would you guys say? And then going into Iowa, that's another winnable game. And then right into homecoming, Northwestern. Northwestern's been playing well, but again, you're at home. That's another winnable game. And then you got, you know, Wisconsin, even though they've been playing awful. Purdue, I think they've been playing very well. Michigan, you're probably not going to win that one. Nebraska and Michigan State are going to be tough ones. Illinois, you can probably win. So these are very winnable games, and you have to do whatever you can to win. And if it's bringing Shortell in for a couple drives, that's fine. I still think if Gray is healthy, he's your guy. But at the same point, at this point, you don't really have an option, I guess.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. Though I will say, I tend to agree with you, Matt, that if Shortell gives you the better chance to win, then you've got to ride with Shortell. And
sure,
if Gray has lost half a step due to the high ankle sprain later in the season, if he's not 100% running, I think you've really, really got to consider playing Shortell. This is hard.
Yeah,
this is hard for me, right? Because I was as big of a fan as Gray as there was, and I still am. I love the kid. I think he's fantastic, and I think he's persevered through some pretty difficult circumstances both before he got to the U and while he's at the U. So I want to give him every possible chance to hold on to that job. And the, you know, the emotional Rube side of me says, no, it's Gray's team no matter what. Let him, you know, let's ride or die with Gray. But the logical side of me saw that, again, maybe coincidentally, yesterday we were a lot more comfortable throwing the ball with Shortell. Again, circumstances may have dictated that. And if he is able to carry over the success that he had yesterday into the next few weeks, and that opens up the running game for us, it's going to be really, really hard to not say, okay, let's stick with Shortell and find ways to use Gray. Maybe bring him in at quarterback for a few series, maybe get him on the field as a wide receiver or something along those lines. The fact of the matter is we have to get Gray on the field. And if Shortell gives us a better chance at the quarterback spot to win the game, how do we work Marquise in there? Now, to everyone's point that we've made thus far, it's a moot point right now because Gray isn't healthy enough to play. But I think QBK's 2K12 is going to become a reality after the bye week if Shortell has proven that he's capable of leading this team.
Yeah, so again, this to your point, Frothy, quarterback controversies only exist when the backup quarterback comes in and wins. So you can't have a quarterback controversy fundamentally when you've only played one game and the backup quarterback came in due to an injury. If Shortell comes in and beats Syracuse and beats Iowa and does so in convincing fashion in either game, then I think we can have a healthy debate about this. But right now, it's just sort of conjecture and people just sort of projecting that, oh, Shortell is so much better for this offense. He's because it opens up the passing game. We pass more with him. That opens up the running game. We are a more complete offense. No, I mean, let's be realistic. I mean, or not realistic, but let's be real here. This team was, heading into this game, number one in the Big Ten in passing efficiency. And guess what? We still are number one in the league in passing efficiency, because we find a way to maximize the throws that we have to make. We can make big plays. We are leading in the Big Ten in yards per attempt before this game. We're leading the Big Ten in yards per attempt after this game. It's not a question of can Gray. I really do think that this is a matter of personal preference, about a preference about what people want in an offense. Do they simply not like having a quarterback running back against eight-man fronts type offense and then really limiting his throws? I mean, granted, I watch quite a bit of college football and I see a lot of dual threat quarterbacks around the nation. I have to tell people, Gray is in the upper percentile of dual threat quarterbacks around the nation. I think people want him to be like a Heisman contender because he came in with that much hype. When he was being recruited, he's not that level, but he's damn good. All right, and he can win games for this. He can win games for this team with his athletic ability. You can't just simply throw away somebody with that amount of freakish athleticism, drive, maturity, and simple love of the game simply because you prefer to have another style of offense. Now, if we were sucking hind teat on offense, we were averaging only 300 yards a game, this would be a bigger issue. But we're not. We're averaging well over 400. We seem to be pretty balanced between run and pass, and we execute on the pass plays in which we need to. Yeah, the only reason we're talking about this is because Gray's hurt, and Shortell looked great in relief, and Gray had his difficult moments against UNLV. But in the reality of the situation, we are far, far from having the worst dual threat quarterback in the country. In fact, we actually have one of the better ones, and I think people need to remember that.
Yeah, and let's not forget, and this may be the end of our QB Gaze 2K12 discussion, but let's say, continuing along the ridiculous hypothetical, that we're undefeated going into the Northwestern game, Gray is healthy. We make the decision to say, okay, we need Gray on the field, so he can't be a backup quarterback for us. He's going to have to play wide receiver. That would continue the situation that we appear to be in right now, where the big Minnesota Jesus, Philip Nelson, is currently our backup quarterback. Now, the hope, I think, for all of us and anyone who follows the Gophers, is that there was no chance in hell that Philip was going to play this year, that he'd be redshirted so he could learn the system, get better physically, et cetera, et cetera. So are we really looking at a situation right now where with Gray out and Shortell our starter, is Philip Nelson our backup quarterback, or do we see Leidner being moved ahead of him? Do we see old Dexter Flattop Foreman coming in there? Do we see the slanging Samoan Moses Alapate coming back? Where are we at with the backup quarterbacks?
So I think that this is a very good question, very good point that you brought up here, Frothy, that if you play out the string of QB Gaze 2K12 all the way to its conclusion of moving Gray to wide receiver, if that's your prerogative, that you're putting yourself in a situation where you now are down to one quarterback that has any game experience. You have a guy who's not even dressing for the games in Dexter Foreman, and then you have the heralded in-state quarterback that you wanted to redshirt, but now he might have to come into possibly into the game. And you know what that situation spells? The exact same scenario we went through last year. It's where you have a backup, where your backup is a true freshman. That is in no way, shape, or form ideal unless your backup true freshman quarterback happens to be a five-star of like the Ryan Mallett variety, like back in 2008 when Rich Rod recruited him to Michigan. So, or not, 2007, so to speak. But let's just be for real about this. You're not going to move Gray to wide receiver. We don't want to do anything. We want to preserve Philip Nelson's redshirt because it's going to set up the program that much better moving forward. I mean, if we have 2 years of Shortell starting at quarterback and you redshirt Philip Nelson this year, then Nelson doesn't have to come into the program until he's an experienced redshirt junior. Then 2 years down the road, if we get another quarterback in the 2014 class, he won't have to play until he's a redshirt junior. This is something that never happens at Minnesota. We rarely, if ever, have a system in place in which upperclassmen, experienced redshirt quarterbacks come into the starting role after 3 years of clipboard duty and learning how to play and getting mop-up duty type plays. This is what great programs do. Minnesota has never done this. In fact, if you go back all the way, so Brian Cupido came in as a redshirt as a sophomore. Weber started all four of his years. Asad Abdul-Khalik came in as an underclassman. I mean, Corey Sauter came in as an underclassman. I mean,
that is a name we have not heard in several years.
It goes back two decades that we have not been able to develop a quarterback. So for the love of the based football gods, can we please be able to redshirt Philip Nelson? Please.
So let's assume then that, so even for the next few games, is Nelson our backup quarterback, or are we going to do everything we can to preserve his redshirt?
Yes, he's our de facto backup quarterback, but this is going to be one of those scenarios, I think, like in 2008, where Adam Weber was basically Iron Man, and we didn't have a backup quarterback because there was literally no one. So Shortell is your starter for the next couple of games, and you just hope and pray that nothing ever happens to him. Maybe if it only looks like he's dinged up, they can just run KJ May and the Wildcat for a couple plays. And then it's as though we don't have to pull the redshirt off of Philip Nelson. But yes, he is the backup. They're preparing him this week. There's quotes already in the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press that Philip Nelson's preparing as if he has to enter the game and he's going to be the number two, which scares me.
They better tell Ginger Balls to stop, you know, trying to block defensive ends on running plays like he was doing yesterday, because I don't really want to lose him to, you know, getting cut block or something as he's out there trying to block or something.
Oh. He tried to bowl someone over on a run as well.
Yeah, that's one.
And he hit the shoulder.
Yeah, that's one of the things I was so pissed off about in the game chat. I'm like, don't lead with your shoulder.
Oh, God. I think everyone was like, no. You know, it was a collective across everyone every Gopher fan that was watching. It was probably yelling the same thing.
I think Coach Klein has been pumping him up too much.
It must be, man, because I was mashing my keyboard and just screaming in the press box, like, what are you doing, Shortell? It's like we just lost our car starting quarterback. Are we going to lose you too? This is, I mean, yeah. I I've had enough of QBGaze. I don't want to talk about this anymore. I'm getting way too amped up. But so, yeah, basically, QBGaze 2012 doesn't exist because Gray's hurt. We don't have the starting quarterback, so we have to bring in the backup. Phil Nelson is elevated to de facto backup. You hope and pray that he doesn't come in, and we'll see how everything goes from here. If we have a controversy 3 weeks from now, we'll talk about it more. But let's move on to what is a less reported aspect of this game, but I think it is equally, if not more important, and that is the play of the secondary again. For the third week in a row, the Gopher secondary has broken up passes, made life very difficult for opposing starting quarterbacks, and along with the play of the defensive line, especially Rashid Hageman, a.k.a. Optimus Prime, D.L. Wilhite, Michael Amafulua, these guys are getting after quarterbacks and just battering them. It is a dramatic turnaround, and I'm willing to say from the old Seinfeld classic line, they are real and they are spectacular.
That's fantastic. You know, I thought I read this morning, and I haven't had a chance to check it out. I thought I read this morning that D.L. Wilhite is leading the Big Ten in sacks right now. Is that right?
I'll check quick.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's leading the Big Ten in sacks right now, or is at least tied for the lead in Big Ten sacks. And that's just fantastic. I absolutely couldn't be happier with our defensive line and our defensive backs. Our linebackers, I think, still leave a lot to be desired. But the way that these guys have stepped up, and with the exception of Wilhite, they're all juniors or less, and most of them are sophomores or redshirt freshmen. So the fact that our line has stepped up as much as they have, I think, is terrific. Now, I think they're much, much better against the pass than they are the run. And part of that is probably just the way that Clay's schemes. He wants the defensive lineman upfield, which is going to open up some holes or some running lanes for the running backs. But their approach to the pass has been absolutely fantastic. I'm thrilled. It was great to see Amafulua get a sack yesterday. Hageman was a beast again. And was really in for most of the game. I didn't see Alex Keith in there hardly at all, to my recollection. Roland Johnson got quite a bit of play. Botticelli got quite a bit of play. But I would, of the snaps where I was paying attention and not still blacked out, I would say that Hageman was probably in for 70 to 80% of the snaps, which is great. And the defensive backfield, I was concerned when I heard that Martez Shabazz was going to be out with a dislocated toe. I was a little bit concerned given the fact that Western Michigan has that propensity to go, sometimes four or five wide, and would we have the horses in the defensive backfield to keep up? As it turned out, yes, we were. The defensive backfield played great, and Western Michigan ended up lining out of power formations probably as much or more than they did out of sort of more traditional spread sets. So the defensive backfield wasn't tested as much as they were. But it did. They did expose our linebackers for what they are, which is, I think, marginally competent in some ways, or probably a best case, and maybe a dumpster fire in other cases. They weren't able to plug the holes, which allowed Western Michigan to really run through us. I wasn't as surprised or negative about the fact that Western Michigan got as many yards rushing as they did yesterday, just given the fact that we were, in all likelihood, preparing for a more wide-open passing attack. We were able to neutralize that, but that left us exposed to the running game. I think our linebackers aren't great at fighting off of blocks. I don't think they're great at hitting the point of attack. They seemed a step or two behind in filling up gaps, which allowed lots of penetrating runs. I don't think we're as susceptible to the counter as we were last year, which is great because I can't stand watching another game against Michigan where we give up 5,000 rushing yards on counters. But I think our linebackers, contrary to what I thought going into the season, are the weakest part of our defense. It's been a long time since we've had confidence in our defensive line and our defensive backfield. If we just had one or two linebackers step up, Emmanuel is getting there. I noticed him flying around quite a bit yesterday, but we aren't real assertive. We don't really have a great defensive stopper in the linebacking core. And that's going to be a problem, I think, against rush first teams.
Just to jump in quick, sorry. D.L. Wilhite is actually leading the conference right now with 3.5 sacks. He's above four guys, which is more than he had last year, actually all of last year. There's four guys behind him with three. One of those guys is, of course, Rashid Hageman. But sorry to stop. And then Amefala has what is it? How many sacks does he have? Oh, he has 1.5. But
yeah. So one of the things I'll just dovetail off of what you're saying here, Frothy, and that what's really disappointing to me is that this senior laden group of linebackers is really not very aggressive, and that's disappointing because every other aspect of the defense is very aggressive. I mean, the defensive line just absolutely hammers people. I mean, I can't count the number of times where Hageman would just blow somebody up and then just absolutely crush Alex Carter. In fact, I think on maybe the second to last series, there was a play right before the smash route touchdown that Will Hite was called for interference, but on basically a phantom call, and that Hageman just burst through the line, just absolutely flattened Alex Carter, and he did that on a number of occasions. And the secondary, again, led by Derek Wells, very, very aggressive. Michael Carter played his best game as a Gopher last night, and he basically shut down his wide receiver was basically blanketed. He was completely erased whenever Carter was on him. He had one interception and three PBUs. He probably could have had another interception that probably would have gone for a pick six. He was great in coverage, always made things very tough for the Western Michigan wide receivers, and I couldn't be more pleased with that. But getting back to the linebackers, yeah, they're not very aggressive. I think the most aggressive one out of the bunch is, as you said, Frothy, James Manuel. He seems to be the only one that really attacks and fills gaps and seems to be able to either sidestep or, you know, run right through a block by just overwhelming a blocker with his, you know, speed and athleticism. And he's the only one that does it. You know, everybody else, you know, Rallis, Cooper, Reeves to a certain extent, they just sort of sit there and just don't really have the awareness to really attack what they need, attack the gaps, and it just leaves us gashed. I would love for our linebackers to behave like the Utah State linebackers did against Wisconsin and Camp Randall last night, where they would just simply knew that they had a hole to fill, they were rushing to fill it, and then when they got there, they were standing up Monty Ball. I would love to see more of that, because I think when that happens, we will become a more complete defense with very few limitations. But right now, this is definitely our biggest weakness. The back half of our Big Ten schedule is against heavy rushing teams that are going to attack this. So it's going to leave us vulnerable against the pass. But the good thing about this is for any and all passing teams that are primarily, you know, quick, either quick three-step, five-step drops, or if they try and hit a lot of downfield routes, they're not going to be able to do it. And they're definitely going to have to bring in extra protection in the form of a tight end back against this defensive line.
So on the linebacker side, do we think that that's a holdover from the Brewster philosophy on defense, or the Kevin Cosgrove philosophy on defense, where there was much more the defensive line would hold, and then the linebackers were expected to read and react, whereas under Clay's, the defensive line attacks, and there's sort of probably more specific gap accountability for linebackers. Do we see that as the linebackers that we see today were really recruited for a different sort of system than we have, or is it just a matter of their mentality and they're not as aggressive as they should be?
I think you'd almost have to be an aggression issue in that, you know, after a guy like Keenan Cooper, who's played now for 4 years, or, you know, as he's really played extensive time, he, you know, he is what he is at the collegiate level. And if he isn't really that kind of, I don't want to say seek and destroy type linebacker, cause I just made that up. If he isn't a guy that's really, you know, hitting gaps hard and he's more read and react, that's just who he is. And that's kind of what he's been doing. But what have you seen with that, MV?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a combination of both with this. First of all, it's tough to tell what kind of defensive scheme that a lot of these Brewster recruits were recruited to, because it changed every single year. So a guy, I mean, when Keenan Cooper was getting recruited, and so was, you know, and Spencer Reeves, they were recruited to Everett Withers style, which is more of an attacking style, and Ted Roof style was more attack, aka let's blitz and pray. So It's tough to tell. Cosgrove definitely was the coordinator that they've been around the longest, and he had a completely different philosophy than Clay's and Ted Roof or Everett Withers. So it is sort of an issue with this. But I do fundamentally think this is about a lack of aggression. I know that this defensive staff against the run game, they're fundamentally the thing that they say is the biggest part of running run defense is toughness. They mentioned it when they first got here that defensive line or pass defense, especially on the D line, is all about technique. There's a lot of technique involved in order to be able to get free and use your hands and warp your body into positions where you actually get offensive linemen off balance so you can counterpunch and then rip and swim in order to get into the backfield. Front seven run defense is all about gap responsibility and toughness. You have to be able to fill the gap, fill your lane, understand that you're going to get a hat on a fullback, tight end, or a pulling guard, and it's going to be physical. So you have to be physical, you have to play tough, you have to be aggressive. You have to be controlled when you're aggressive. And I just don't think that the linebackers are there as of yet. It's to the point where I'm almost wondering if the staff isn't going to recruit some JUCO linebackers who fit that mentality more, because if they don't have this with coming back next year with Lamonte, if Lamonte can't step up, Manuel seems to be progressing and doing really well with this. I think he fits the mold of what they want. I didn't see Beal out there almost at all yesterday. I think he was in on special teams, but he really didn't get in the mix at middle linebacker. But these are things that we need. This run defense really needs more toughness and aggression, and just simple awareness that you have gaps you have to hit, and you need to fill them. And they're just simply not doing that right now.
How come you think Beal wasn't in the mix?
I really couldn't tell you. I don't know. It was a disappointment to me at the game, and then when I watched the film again this morning, I can't explain why. I mean, maybe he was injured. Maybe he was banged up. Maybe they figured because of that Rallis is a little bit better in coverage responsibilities, and so is Aaron Hill, that they were going to rotate him in more because they were going to see less run, more pass. And it actually ended up probably being around 50-50 run and pass. So I don't quite know. They ended up playing a lot of the youngsters again in the second half, so you saw a lot of Alex. I saw quite a bit of Alex Keith and Scott Ekpe and Tieran Cochran along that line. But to the linebacker point, I don't know. I really don't. I mean, it's an issue. It's going to be an issue this year. I think that they have schemed around it, and they play to the strengths of their defense and try to minimize this as much as they possibly can, but it'll be an issue moving forward. So, with that, with everything we have, we've talked about here, Syracuse, what are we expecting of this game? I just checked the line. It is Gophers -1. So, yes, that would mean that the Gophers would be considered underdogs on a neutral field, and I think that may be an apt description of this. I think that this is definitely a pick'em type game between us and Syracuse, because Syracuse is a better team than Western Michigan. They're actually very similar. I think their quarterback, Ryan Nassib, is better than Alex Carter. Syracuse has better talent overall than Western Michigan. But I don't think that we're going to run into the same issues that we had against Western Michigan with the formation bukkake and bringing out 14 players onto the field with, three wide receivers and then running them off and running in tight ends and, tight end and all this other crap that Bill Kubit likes to pull. I think Syracuse plays it a little bit more traditionally, but they are fundamentally a sort of dink and dunk, and then the play action type team, and then they will try and hit you over the top.
I feel okay about this game, even though this is the best team the Gophers have likely played so far, simply because if you have to go against a pass first team or a run first team with this defense, like we were just talking about with the linebackers in the secondary a little bit, I'd much rather face a pass first team. And with Nassib, they certainly are that.
I don't know. I haven't watched much Syracuse football at all. Just looking at the scores last week, they beat Stony Brook by a little bit. The Seabed, a nice game. I feel at home. It's a winnable game, and granted, Gray will be out, but I'm fairly confident the defense can hopefully step up and kind of lead the Gophers this week, simply because the secondary has played so well.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I don't really know very much about Syracuse. The Big East is the conference that I follow probably the least. Sorry, Mangus, but I guess if I had to find a way to beat Syracuse, I'd probably look at that Northwestern game tape. What was the final score of that game? 47-46 or something like that, where neither team had any defensive note. Though it sounds like Syracuse righted the ship a little bit for USC, and then almost had the complete opposite problem when they played Stony Brook yesterday, where neither team was really able to score. But I would have to believe that the keys to beating that team are within the Northwestern game tape and the Stony Brook game tape. So we'll see what happens. I'm relatively optimistic, but I think you started off this call this podcast saying it the right way. This is probably the biggest game of the Jerry Kill era. I think if we win this game, we're really pretty well situated to go to a bowl game. So are we going to win? I don't know. I think -1 is probably about right. I don't know that Syracuse has Syracuse has gone through a lot of the same troubles that we have over the last several years, and having a coach that didn't do them any favors, kind of gutted the program, and are now on their way to rebuilding. So I would probably say that the line should be a pick 'em. So it's probably pretty close to which should be. But with that said, I'm certainly no expert in Syracuse football.
So I'm just looking at CFBstats.com, which is one of my two or three favorite college football statistical sites that I go ahead and look at. Syracuse defense is last in the Big East in rushing defense. In rushing defense, yards per rush allowed. They allow 5.4 yards per carry. They are also last in the conference in passing efficiency defense. They're towards the middle in yards per attempt allowed. So I think that this is a product of the fact that they have played two teams in Northwestern and USC that are West Coast three-step, five-step drop type teams that will, complete these shorter passes. And in the case of USC, they will hit things over the top. Offensively, they are just they are phenomenal. I mean, they are they're middle of the pack in terms of yards per attempt because they are sort of a pass happy type team. They're attempting about 50 passes a game. So when I say that they're almost exactly like Western Michigan, it's because it's true. They pretty much are exactly like Western Michigan. Not particularly a really strong rushing team, but I think just like the Broncos, they're capable when they need to be, and if you try and over-scheme to stop the pass, then they can hit you really hard on the run by getting into situations where you're forcing to play nickel and dime, and then they bring in some extra tight ends and run a little bit up the middle, RUTM. But I think this is going to be a very big challenge. I mean, Nasib is rated relatively highly on some NFL draft boards for the 2013 draft. I think he is projected somewhere in the neighborhood of being between a third and fourth round quarterback. I mean this in the best way possible. He's got a little bit of Adam Weber in him, just looking at his statistical profile. He's not a guy that's going to blow you away with his completion percentage, and his yards per attempt are low, but he's capable. He can make smart throws. Against USC, at least from the first half of that game that I watched, he's very capable. He has big players at receiver, so it'll be a really nice challenge. I think after this particular game, we will know without a shadow of a doubt what the strength of this defense is and whether or not this defensive line and secondary can be able to hold up throughout the year, and just how much of that we can how much can we rely upon those two units to carry the defense throughout the year when it's clear to everyone that rushing defense is going to be a weakness?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Speaking of me feeling better about our rushing defense. I feel better about our rushing defense against the Wisconsin game coming up in about a month or so, because watching that offensive line last night.
Seriously, what has happened with Wisconsin, though? I mean, the wheels have fallen off quick and completely off.
Hey, you know, I think Bielema should fire Matt Canada next. I mean, that's the logical conclusion, right? If your offensive line sucked against Oregon State, that means you have to fire your offensive line coach the very next day. And if your offense and quarterback suck and your offensive line sucks against Utah State at home, that means you have to fire your offensive coordinator, right? That's the way Burt does things, correct? Am I right?
Oh, you're right. Yep, blame Canada.
he benched O'Brien. Did O'Brien come back in at the end? I didn't think he did.
No, it was Joel Stove.
They did a guy in, right? So then, are they going to move ahead without O'Brien? I guess because they have the redshirt freshman. But that whole, I'm just shocked watching it, and I just kept laughing because it was so great watching them lose, and it was a game they, by all intents and purposes, should have lost. Do we know anything about UTEP this Saturday? Are they in the same realm as Utah State? Are they? I would think they're worse than Utah State, but UTEP, I think. I'm trying to think who was the coach that was there a couple years ago, but is Price still there?
I believe Price is still there. I'm going to be honest with you guys. I don't know shit about UTEP, but one thing I do know about Utah State is that they came in with a lot of momentum by beating Utah for the first time in, I think, over a decade at Romney Stadium in Logan, Utah. So they had momentum on their side. They were not intimidated by Wisconsin at all. I'm sure when they saw the tape of the Oregon State game, they were licking their chops thinking, oh my God, this offensive line is terrible. Danny O'Brien is a shit quarterback. Without Aberderis, they have basically no skill position players whatsoever that can do anything. It's literally, this is a deeply, deeply flawed offensive football team. It starts with the offensive line that can't do anything. I mean, Monty Ball looks absolutely pedestrian now because he doesn't have guys that are blocking 6, 7, 8 yards down the field for him. The right side of that offensive line is terrible. I think that Matthias Kidd got flagged about 6 or 7 times and was just getting blown off the ball constantly. Danny O'Brien is a mess. Joel Stove isn't really that much better, but I think he has less of the Edsall Ebola still left in him. In fact, he has no Edsall Ebola, unlike Danny O'Brien, who was, let's be clear, people shouldn't even mention his name and Russell Wilson's in the same sentence ever again. This was all a desperate attempt by Burt Bielema to sort of patch things together because he knew he had to strike while the iron was hot. Because the leaders division is so wide open, but I'm literally confident when I say this that I do not believe Wisconsin will not win more than 8 games this year. The 8 might even be pushing it. Given their schedule, I do not see how they're going to beat Ohio State. They might not even beat Penn State. Purdue is going to be tough. They're not going to beat Nebraska. Nebraska is going to wipe the floor with these guys. And we're coming in, depending on how these next 3 weeks go, we could be heading into Madison either 5-1 or 6-0 and on a huge wave of confidence that we can be able to beat these guys for the first time since 1994 in Madison.
I just don't know how they're going to score. I honestly don't know how they're going to score. They have no receivers, until Aberderis comes back. Daniel Bryan is terrible. He's just absolutely awful. And quite frankly, they can't generate a running game. So how are they going to score against better defenses? Bless Utah State, but I don't believe that that's going to be one of the 5 best defenses that Wisconsin plays this year. So how are they going to score? Now, they're clearly going to. Defensively, I think they're a pretty talented team. They held Utah State in check other than a few plays last night. Defensively, they're pretty good. I just don't know how they're going to score. So I don't disagree. I think 8 might be a stretch for them. But, Elliot, you asked what happened, and, I'm not going to sit here and talk about how smart we all are. But on the first, I think it was the second podcast this year where we did the Big Ten review, we talked about the fact that over the last 2 years, Wisconsin has lost 3 or 4 All-American offensive linemen. They lost six coaches, including their offensive coordinator and offensive line coach, who were pretty well regarded to be the heart and soul of what made the Wisconsin offense tick. You lost probably a quarterback who, you know, is.
And Pitt looked good last week,
Yeah, he's the most efficient. He's the most efficient quarterback in FBS history, in Russell Wilson. So you lose all that, and you're going to take some steps back. I think the travesty, to go back to a fun theme that we talk about on these podcasts, is how the hell did no reporter ever really talk about these things? ESPN didn't talk about it. Neither of the Wisconsin papers talked about it. No, none of the Big Ten Network didn't really cover it. You heard things like complacency, but you also heard things like, oh, they always reload there, they'll be fine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No one, everyone just assumed that Wisconsin was going to go on another 10-2, 11-1 season, because that's what Wisconsin has done over the last couple of years. Well, you don't lose pieces like that and just recover. So I'm happy about it. If Wisconsin doesn't get hit by, you know, a 3-mile-wide meteor, and Madison is reduced to, you know, ashes 50,000 feet in the stratosphere, then watching their football team implode right before my very eyes is a very close second.
Well, and before the season, I figured that with, you know, losing, I forget the number of coaches they lost just this offseason, I figured they'd stumble a little bit, but at the same point, they'd have some continuity and be able to move things forward, thinking that they had groomed some offensive linemen, and while they would take a step back, they wouldn't fall down the stairs, to kill the metaphor. But before the season, I figured they'd lose to Nebraska for sure. And that was kind of an upset, I guess, just because I want Nebraska to beat them because I hate Wisconsin. But now, Ohio State, I feel like, beats them in Madison. They have Purdue in Ross-Ade Stadium. I feel like Purdue wins that game. I feel like Purdue's kind of a sneaky team, and it's kind of scary to think that with Ohio State out of the or banned from postseason play, to see that they could possibly win the leaders if things kind of broke the right way for them. But they looked just brutal. I mean, it wasn't last night against Utah State. It wasn't a team that needed to figure things out and, you know, wasn't sure on the scheme and stuff like that. It was just a team getting outplayed and just beat.
So from looking at their upcoming schedule, I mean, I don't want to spend too much time, you know, because I'm not a great Wisconsin football mind, and quite frankly, I don't really care about Bielema. In fact, I revel in the fact that their program is just melting down this year from all the stupid moves that Bielema made.
It was so fun to watch those kids at halftime. I took a picture and put it on Twitter of just the Wisconsin bros that were like, they wanted to cheer, but they were losing, and they were so lost that they were losing to UTEP, because usually they have such a cupcake non-conference schedule.
And how they celebrated, like they won the Rose Bowl after Utah State's kicker missed the field goal.
That was absurd. Like, the whole stadium was going crazy. The players are jumping all over the place. You beat Utah State at home.
And they've been to Rose Bowls recently. Yeah. It wasn't like when the Gophers, when we beat a team we should have already beaten and we haven't gone anywhere. It's like, well, we need that. Let us have that. They've been to significant games. They know what it's like to be in Pasadena. They didn't need to go nuts for Utah friggin' State.
Yeah, I saw some people criticizing us after, you know, running around the field after, you know, Jordan Whitstein hit the walk-off field goal in triple overtime against UNLV. People criticizing our players like, oh, well, you know, act like you've been here, you know. But
they haven't.
They won three games over each of the last 2 years. Wisconsin is different. They have. You're beating Utah State by a missed field goal and a home cook, you know, home cooking from the referee, and that's what you're going to celebrate. You're going to go nuts over that. People realize that Nebraska is going to be steaming mad about what happened to them in their very first Big Ten game in Camp Randall last year, and that Pelini is going to go for the absolute jugular starting in the first September of Big Ten play. Then they have to come home to Illinois, who I don't know what to think about this Illinois team, because Illinois is always such a schizophrenic team. Then they play at Purdue, and Purdue is going to have that game circled, because that is clearly the game that they need to win if they're going to play for the Big Ten title. So Purdue is going to be pissed off. Then they play us. We could potentially have this game circled, because if we take care of business in the next 2 to 3 weeks. Then they play at home against Michigan State. You know Michigan State is going to absolutely destroy this running game. Then they play at Indiana, and then Indiana could be a trap game. Indiana at Indiana is sandwiched between Michigan State and Ohio State at home. How are they possibly going to beat Michigan State and Ohio State? It's not possible.
Unless something really drastic happens to that program in the next 2 weeks. I guess if they keep firing coaches and dig up Frankencoach or God knows what. I don't see after three games, you know, what is it? Do it once, it's an accident. Twice, it's a coincidence. Three times, it's a trend. It's a trend at this point. I mean, they are not the same team they were last year, the year before. It seems as though they're going to have some trouble with the Big Ten season, which, of course, I love watching.
Oh, yeah. The bigger grease fire there is in Madison, the happier I am about it.
Am I crazy for thinking that they could possibly even lose to at Penn State for the season finale?
I don't think it's – if the offensive line continues to play as they're playing and they can't generate a rushing attack – even with Monte Ball back there. No, I think it's hard to identify a lot of wins on that schedule if their offensive woes continue. But we'll see.
Yeah, if Penn State at the end of the year, I feel like Penn State's still so up in the air. I mean, they had a nice win here last week, but still, I still keep waiting for Wisconsin to kind of figure it out and go. But they didn't. They certainly didn't against Utah State. I mean, it wasn't when they won the game. They had the kick return, the punt return. It wasn't as if all of a sudden they kind of turned it on and put Utah State away. I mean, the Aggies essentially really kind of won that game, but you know didn't kick the field goal at the right time.
That particular game feels almost exactly like the North Dakota State game that Glenn Mason played back in 2006, where yeah. He was all aloof after the game, saying, "Oh, well, this is a game you love as a coach because you didn't deserve to win, but you did. You know, you won." So I think Bielema probably comes out in that same regard. I mean, Wisconsin lost every single statistical matchup. They were outgained by Utah State. They only had 234 yards of total offense. They were outgained on the ground. They were outgained through the Wisconsin outgained them, but the yards per rush was only 3.5. And I'm sorry, if you're averaging 3.5 yards a carry against Utah State, you have some big, big issues. They had one offensive touchdown. I think they have their offense is practically worse of a dumpster fire than Iowa's, and we all know Iowa with the angry Iowa running back hating God can't do anything. I mean, this is fantastic. I have such shod boner right now just considering how bad both of our rivals are and how seemingly, you know, like you were saying, Frothy, it's like we're sort of cranky about the way that our team is playing, but we're 3-0. And we have these issues that we don't like, but it's certainly a hell of a lot better than being the position that Wisconsin is in, where they're firing offensive line coaches, they can't score, they have to basically pray that their defense can keep the point total under 15.
Well, I think you nailed it on the head with the Mason comparison. That's Bielma's quote after the game was, "Got to win against quality opponent," and he didn't say much else after that. I mean, I love watching it. I'm so sick of smug Wisconsin fans that act as though it's a storied program. And I'm so sick of hearing Wisconsin fans, you know, level shit on us after they beat us. Or watching Al Toon or Nick Toon. I always call him Al Toon. Watching Nick Toon run around the field with the axe. Nothing would be finer than getting that axe back in Dinky Town.
Yeah, I think that about wraps it up. About sums it up. Where we are, where we're going, and where Wisconsin is going, which is the waste facility. Maybe we can have a nuclear bomb dropped on Camp Randall, and so we can have that radioactively carted away. It'll be a smoldering ruin for the next 1,000 years, but perhaps with the way that Bert Bielema is coaching this team, that it'll be a nuclear fallout anyway.
We can only hope.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
All right, folks. So check back next week where we talk about how much the Ginger Cannon has ripped up the Syracuse secondary and has led us to a 4-0 start for the first time since 2008, or if something else happens. And yeah, let's not even talk about that. Let's keep the positivity train, and but with a slight tinge of complaint going. Until next time, see you later, folks. Take care.